Welcome back to the AAPC podcast and to our ongoing series on the future of political consulting. Today's episode explores an area closely connected to campaign work, yet distinct in its rhythm and responsibilities: advocacy and government relations. We're joined today by Joshua Haberski, CEO of the Premium Cigar Association, and Dr. Casey Burgot, Director of the Legislative Affairs Program at the Graduate School of Political Management. Together, they join in a conversation about how advocacy is evolving and how many of the same skills, tools, and strategic principles used in campaigns now shape year-round influence efforts in Washington. The discussion offers valuable insights for young professionals and anyone thinking about how experience in campaigns or advocacy can translate across both fields. Together, we explore how technology and AI are changing the way organizations mobilize and persuade, where authentic communication and relationship building remain constant, and how firms and practitioners increasingly work across both campaigns and advocacy, opening new pathways for career growth. It's a firsthand look at how these worlds intersect and what that means for the next generation of political professionals. Let's dive in.
Very excited to be on the podcast, and especially with my boss in the other world of the GSPM Legislative Affairs Program. It's an honor to be an adjunct there and learning from Casey. Very excited to just dive into this, campaigns and advocacy. You know, both of us kind of approach it from a different lens, and just want to have a spirited conversation with you about where the future holds.
That should be no problem. There's no shortage of changes going on at all in politics and in what you do, Josh. I mean, you're one of the most snappy dressers out there. You got one of the coolest offices out there, one of the coolest jobs out there with the Premier Cigar Association. So for the listeners, tell them what you do. What's your day-to-day look like?
So other than smoking cigars, it's a full-scale trade association. We have 3,500 retail members, 3,000 manufacturers. We advocate, in addition to being the CEO, I am our chief lobbyist. So I have the White House, FDA, and Congress, and any other tertiary agencies that I advocate and put our issues to the forefront.
Beautiful. So you brought up the Scarlet L of Washington, D.C., and if we live and work in a bubble, right? So the trade associations, the lobbyists are all part of the policymaking game here. But for folks outside of the swamp, the L gets tossed around as like a pejorative, right? Like, you are what's wrong with the country. You are the house of cards that is the house of cards. So break down what a lobbyist is. What is your role to play? And what are your interactions look like on Capitol Hill and within the White House, where they're outside of DC, assuming that you're just showing up with bags of cash and bribing folks to get them to do what you want?
Yeah, you know, I think that the Scarlet L, Hollywood really took that and took it to a different level, because a lot of what we do is we're educators for subsets. I look at like what I do and what you do at GSPM as kind of a continuation. And my subset is to teach my membership about civics and how it applies to their issue set. And then also a little bit of a cheerleader, making issues salient and understandable for, you know, general public. You know, we represent brick and mortar retailers on Main Street. They're out there focusing on selling premium cigars and pipe tobacco to adults. They're not necessarily focused on what's going on within the complexities of the Center for Tobacco Products at the Food and Drug Administration. So, you know, the day-to-day, a lot of it is meeting, educating, you know, telling people that premium cigars are not big cigarettes, talking about where they come from, how they're made, and then leveraging technology and communications tools to amplify my voice, which is hired gun, with our grassroots and grass tops advocates. And that's where I think a lot of the intersections with campaigns come in. Political campaigns, you get a lot of money quickly. Advocacy is more of a sustained burn, but you have new challenges with advocacy because the resources aren't as great, and you have to keep that momentum sustained year round. You know, there's no cycle for advocacy. It's constant.
And this is what a lot of parties learn over and over again is that, just like you said, we think of campaigns as these cyclical things that every 2, 4, 6 years, we're coming and asking you for not only your vote, but your dollars, your attention, your energy. And then once the campaign's over, we're supposed to do everything we promised you through that campaign cycle. But with advocates and trade associations and lobbyists are those conduits, those advocates for us in DC when we can't be there ourselves on our pet issues, right? So you mentioned the sustainability about that. This is an exhausting world, right? Where you're constantly battling for the attention, and more than anything, you're constantly battling for the access to decision makers to not only educate them about your issue, but even bring it up to them as something they've probably never even thought about before. There's no shortage of things to pay attention to. So talk about your strategies to maintain attention, maintain access in your advocacy efforts that campaigns don't necessarily have to do on such a sustained basis.
Yeah, you know, I think it's really monitoring technology trends to amplify that message and looking at new mediums where, you know, staff and elected officials are receiving their information. So part of it is media relations. Part of it is event management. You know, I host many different groups of people at our office here in Washington, D.C., or do visits at any of the retail lounges. We're fortunate we have, you know, a member in pretty much every congressional district. But, you know, we want to, I think one of the emerging challenges that whether you're in the campaign world or the advocacy world is maintaining authenticity while utilizing these, you know, these emerging technologies like AI, for example. You know, you had the form letters, the advocacy communications, you know, we're encouraging people to write things together. It's much easier to send a form letter in, but kind of gauging, is that impactful enough? And it's similar to, you know, you have to communicate in multiple different layers. Communicate to your advocates and your membership in the sense of a trade association, much like campaigns communicate to voters, but then you have to mobilize them to do some type of action. So a lot of times it can get cross in communicating to one of those subgroups, and a lot of associations will take kind of one technology and try to do the shotgun approach versus the rifled approach.
So this is not a one size fits all. Just because you may have the right idea, the right policy, the right time, doesn't mean you have the access or the message for all audiences at once. So you have to pick and choose what you're saying to whom and what messaging you're given. So where does the crossover with campaigns who always struggle with the same thing, right? Of like getting people to not only know what you stand for, but to care about what you stand for, and then what you care about is the right thing to do. So where's the overlap with campaigns who are good at knocking on doors, good at this like last minute crunch, register, get out there, do your job type thing on a one set action? Yours is a more constant, sustained effort, but where's the overlap lay?
It's really building a sense of community and doing it through a combination of in-person and digital. Like, you know, I think some of the tried and true traditional technologies, bringing a few of those back occasionally and the face-to-face interactions are incredibly important if you're going to have that sustained momentum. It can't all be digital. It can't, obviously, because of resource constraints, be all traditional and in person. So, you know, leveraging both at the right part of the legislative cycle, and also looking at the campaign side. Now, you know, trade associations also dabble in the campaign world as well. That's, you know, not only the political action committees with C6 organizations, but like the voter outreach, general messaging. And that's where I really kind of harp on that civics 101, where they're teaching people, you know, we have voter registration information on our website. We have a tool called Cigar Action, where that's really for general public consumers. But, you know, this past election cycle at the presidential level, for the first time, we did engagements at the DNC and the RNC for general awareness. And it was very impactful. So we're kind of monitoring what's going on in the campaign world. You know, if I did a similar interview 6, 8 years ago, I would have said, you know, the consumer world is 10 years ahead of the advocacy world, and the campaign world is 5 years ahead of the advocacy world. I think the advocacy world and the campaign world have actually gotten a lot closer. You see a lot of consultancies because they like to make a lot of money quickly with the political campaigns, but then they don't want to have to lay off and get rid of staff. They want to have, again, a sustained consultancy. They will add on advocacy, lobbying, and public affairs and grassroots as another vertical to their business. So a lot of the top firms are offering a multitude of services in both the practical political campaign world and the advocacy world. And where we kind of learned a lot of that technology was representing a trade association. We have private companies that are using these consumer tools that then we're adapting in the advocacy world.
So that seems like a growing trend, which makes sense from just an economic perspective, right? Like keep everything in-house, provide all this a la carte service to your customers, right? That makes sense. But is there are there any trade-offs of doing that? Is it a confusing type of business for either your advocate folks, your campaign folks? Do they not like to mix with each other? Like what are the downsides of having all those verticals within a business?
I think really being too partisan, especially as a company, you know, at the corporate level, nonprofit level, trade level, like if you go too far down the route. So that's why we make sure as a trade association, everything that we're doing is bipartisan. We're not, you know, harping on messaging. We're not bashing Democrats or Republicans. We're bashing certain policies that apply to our membership. And as we kind of stay above the fold, I think a lot of times where it gets a little bit messy, you see flavor of the day, you know, somebody tweets out or X posts on X something, or, you know, something makes a national headline and a group, a trade association latches onto it. You know, there's a social movement that has different factions. The best thing you can do as a trade association, in my opinion, is to stay far away. And if it doesn't have any applicability to your issue set, I want to be the resource on premium cigars, specialty tobacco retail, and that's it. They don't want to know what I think about Super Bowl ads or halftime shows or whatever. I stay very close in my lane and want to be the authority on that limited scope of things. And then we engage on the issues that apply to our membership and our trade association. So, you know, for instance, kind of a hot button issue of the day has been tariffs. Tariffs, we sent out information that applies to our industry, you know, positives and negatives associated with those. And it was an informational piece of how to wade through them. And then we expressed with the appropriate regulators in the White House our thoughts on it collectively after receiving feedback from our membership.
This brings up a point in an increasingly electronic world, right? A lot of stuff can get done over email, through text, a lot of AI, which I'm sure we'll get to in a second, given its impact on all businesses, and I'm sure yours as well. But talk about the need for genuine relationships, right? Like what you just mentioned about being the known quantity on your particular subset requires that someone's calling you, someone's deferring on you. You are a known quantity in that space, which I doubt is able to be built without literally being in the room and in front of people. So despite transitioning into a 2025 technological environment, talk about the value of relationships and how that's remained a constant, whether you're on the campaign side or the advocacy side.
Yeah, you definitely have to have a physical presence. You have to shake hands. You have to meet a lot of people. And like, you know, and taking the, I've been a lobbyist now for over a decade, and, you know, taking on the role of CEO, I'm shocked at how much time I spend with membership and meeting them to mobilize them to then, and I think it's created or made our association better advocates for our cause. It's not me doing 300 meetings and seeing the career transition to start as a lobbyist, where I built the relationships here in DC to then go out into the field, and literally the fields and factories in, you know, Dominican Republic, Honduras, and Nicaragua, and getting those stories, it builds a clearer picture. I mean, it requires a ton of travel and human capital to do that. I mean, I'm on the road 200 days plus out of the year. That it's very taxing. You have to be able to utilize the technology to maintain the traditional DC workload. And I think you're seeing the advent, and political consultants on the campaign level have always got it, because it was a fixed amount of time where, especially if you're doing a presidential race, you're all around the country. So they've gotten used to that. I've had to adapt a little bit of like, all right, you know what? I have a 2-hour window where I'm going to be in the Admirals Club, and I have to get these presentations for my board of directors together and fire off, you know, 5 emails to congressional offices to make sure we're in the right position there. So it's utilizing technology to kind of juggle your workload. You know, we're a very traditional trade association, and like a lot of the emerging technologies, because our membership isn't necessarily using them, some of our manufacturers are, but at the retail level, you still have people that are in cash only establishments. So I think by the nature of the membership that you represent, that kind of determines how quickly you adapt some of these new technologies. So we've been a little bit slower versus most trade associations that are actively using AI. We use it a little bit on the advocacy technology side. But aside from that, you know, we're not using it as rampantly as I know some of my peers in the association world are using.
Dang, Admiral status, I'm sure you earned it, but that's a nice access, brother. Get in there. They make it life hand a little handy there.
Not too many espressos after missed flights.
It can add up for sure. So let's get to the AI portion, because it can do. I see this in the classroom a lot. I see this in just presentation components. A lot of the stuff that, you know, that requires a lot of time, but are similar actions, it can be pretty good at saving a lot of the time. But on the advocacy and campaign front, how are you like, what are your prompts? What are you telling it to do? And how can it help you serve your position? And then I definitely want to get to you the pitfalls of it, where you found holes in the strategies it's hopefully saving you time for, but actually ends up costing you more time or even credibility.
Yeah, definitely synthesizing large amounts of information, large amounts of data.
Like what in your world?
So a lot of legal advocacy, litigation. You know, I'm a non-lawyer, but we are actively involved in, we've sued the Food and Drug Administration 3 times, and we were successful in all 3 of those. We have a couple other cases that, you know, we're looking at. If you're going to make the investment as an association into filing a hundreds of thousand dollars at the low end lawsuit and millions of dollars at the higher end, you want to have all of your ducks in a row. And as a non-lawyer, it's kind of helped me synthesize, you know, what is the precedent, you know, what are some of the basics there before I go and have a conversation with a lawyer that charges $700 an hour or more. So, you know, I think on legal advocacy, that's where I myself have used a lot of AI in the synthesis side. You know, in the academia, and I'll turn it around to you also in this, I've been averse with it, you know, kind of telling my students, learn the organic skills, the human capital first of like a literature review. I see so many people wanting to use that as kind of a crutch. I would rather, you know, develop that skill set after I know how to do it myself and have the painstaking time. So, you know, on the academic side, I have not used it. Whereas, you know, in the practical side, when it applies to legal advocacy, I have.
And do you, what about like, I mean, your whole goal, whether you're talking to members of Congress, staffers, the White House, or even voters on the campaign side, you're out for persuasion, right? Yep. Maybe they are predispositioned to agree with what you want, but you still want to arm them with some information to take back to their bosses, their voters, their constituents, of why this is the right thing to do right now. And so how do you use AI, or how do you think that you might want to invest in AI or technology to help with that persuasion front? I mean, we see campaigns struggle with us all the time of trying to, we see it on our social medias, definitely, of the algorithms turned up to 11, but campaigns don't have that type of power within their algorithms. So where are you falling or relying on technology to help with that targeting, and maybe even the, how do you say this nicely, the technologically skilled way of getting people to care on their doom scrolling?
Yeah, foundational. I mean, we're in a content overload. We have been for years. We are constant. I'm constantly doom scrolling, even when I have
In the
a bunch
Admirals
of
Club, at
other stuff
least.
in the Admiral's Club with my espresso doom scrolling. You're trying to break through the noise and do things that are authentic and kind of eye-catching. You don't want to be kind of the run-of-the-mill, just communicating for the sake of communicating. It isn't a frequency game as much as it is quality in this day and age. So getting AI to give you some of the foundational information, I think, is important, but not losing sight of, for the association being the CEO, I believe that I have the voice of the association. I've taken that, and it's taken me 6 years to really figure out exactly what that voice is. And there's nothing that, technology, AI, any tool can do to replace that voice, because it's organic and it's after the constant feedback. Now, it can get you and increase that output and increase that frequency, but I'm quality control. I'm quality control of the message that you churn out. So, on any given day, we have five or six releases. And I think a lot of my communications team and our membership team, they have the ability to use a lot more AI than on the advocacy side. The advocacy side, you one little mistake can cost you any credibility that you built up over a number of years if you get it wrong. So we have to make sure that if we're utilizing these tools, you have systems in place and checks in place to make sure that you're not just rubber stamping it and taking it for granted. It cannot replace human capital.
You mentioned you've been a lobbyist and in this space for over a decade now. What's been the biggest change or two in the space? Like, not maybe in your interactions, the reliance on technology. What's absolutely different when you turn back the clock? You're like, I cannot believe we used to do it that way.
Yeah, I think the fly-in model is coming back a little bit now. It had a little bit of a hiatus. Obviously, the pandemic and COVID really shifted things. It caused a bit of a cluster for a while. And it's nice now having the ability to do, virtual meetings in addition to in person. I don't have to, wear a suit to every meeting and go to the Hill. Like, if I'm doing member visits in Miami, I can meet with a staffer virtually. So, it's become a lot more efficient in that sense through the years. But occasionally, and I mentioned we're a little disruptive in our association and how I've approached any of my jobs in advocacy. So, like, I follow pop culture very closely, and like, we'll throw in song lyrics into a subject line of an action email or even a letter going to Congress. Like, we want to make sure people are looking. And sometimes, like, you'll get feedback if you throw in a Swedish House Mafia lyric into a email subject line. Some staffer is going to get it, and they're going to respond, "Oh, that was creative." So, like, we try and do things that are a little bit out there. One campaign a couple years ago, and I was working with Professor Franco at the Diabetes Association, and this was actually 8 years ago. We actually ran a fax campaign at the state level, and we kind of brought back the fax. They still had fax machines, and it ended up being a successful campaign because people still have fax machines. They just don't get used all the time. So sometimes when you're looking at technology to kind of take you to the next level, you got to almost look to old school and do the antithesis of technology.
Holy smokes. That leads to the question. I mean, throwing some Swedish House Mafia in an email that can work, a fax machine can work. What were your biggest misses? Where'd you try and just absolutely airballed?
Yeah, you know, I think sometimes with pack solicitation, you know, we wanted to be detail oriented and like you're trying to raise money during a cycle where everyone's trying to raise money. So, you know, I think that that is where we had some misses where we tried to get a little bit tongue in cheek with you know, some of the pop culture things, and it when it was tied to political giving or PAC giving, it was really a missed opportunity. People weren't reading it. They weren't, you know, they would click on it and kind of reject it. So I think it becomes difficult. Like for PAC giving, I've seen shorter is better. Like we want to know what this is going to, how much you're asking for, and what's the rationale, and nothing else. Cut out, you know, we would have mailers that were 2 or 3 pages. We'd have emails that were 5 or 6 paragraphs. Shorter was sweeter, you know. So like that's kind of translated in overhauling our communications to short form communications. Now it's odd in the legal sense and the regulatory side of things, they want long form communication. So kind of getting the temperature of your membership, your board of directors, whoever your constituency is, and then utilizing the medium, the method, and actually the volume. You have to have volume control with it of how much you're sharing with them. Because, you know, if you put these 10-page memos together all the time, no one's going to read them. It can be as great as you want. So like I tell my team, like, don't keep it to a page. Like I'm going from project to project, short, sweet, to the point. What is the ask? And that is tried and true with campaigns and advocacy. Obviously, in the campaign, there's a winner and loser. You want the vote. You want the dollars going to the campaign. In advocacy, the ask is, you know, sign on to this bill, support this, don't support this. So, you know, there's a lot of similarities there.
Let's talk about the skill sets to be on the advocacy or even the campaign front, right? Because they're becoming more and more similar. Where this isn't for everybody, right? Like this takes a certain amount of skill set, the same way that it takes a certain skill set to be a lawyer or a doctor or a teacher. It's just not for everybody to walk into. And a lot of people struggle with that word you just came up with, right? They care about an issue, they care about it very deeply, they're personally connected to it, but then it becomes about the ask, the actual telling someone. And I tell students this all the time, I tell trade organizations this all the time, is like, this is the culture of DC. These people are constantly being asked for things and they're constantly asking people for things. This is the transaction nature. It's not the money in bags thing that people feel about DC, but it's literally that direct. It is that political. It is that transactionary. And so give someone maybe younger in their position in this field or thinking about going into advocacy, which includes nonprofits, right? Your good government, your do-gooders, your climate changers, all of that stuff. Like those are advocacy. And you're going to want access to the same rooms that people for big oil or big pharma are in, right? That's the game you're inserting yourself into. How should they think about the transactionary nature of this? The direct ask, is it something they should avoid, or is this something that will never go away? And if you're not making it, someone else will.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a lot of trial and error. You know, I remember first starting out in DC, and you know, I was a little bit younger and naiver, and
Less well dressed, though, I can guarantee that.
probably, you know, I think now I'm a little bit jaded. You know, I think that it's one of those things where the system and the cycle gets to you. You kind of get almost you run out of energy of going through that kind of rat race, going to the receptions where, you know, everybody's asking for a contract, everyone's asking for a job. You know, the first question is what do you do? Everyone jokes about that in DC, but that is the reality of it.
And
And
why is that? Let's break it down. Why, like, what is that saying? It's not uncommon to say you meet someone at a bar and say, "Hey, what do you do?" But it's different in DC. What are they actually asking?
what can you do for me?
Yep.
I mean, that's the exact question of, and if it is, you could meet somebody that's a president of a bank or a lawyer, but if it doesn't apply to your sector, they could have as great of a career or interesting story. It's like you're moving on. So it is a very transactional town in that sense. I think to be successful here, you have to chase causes and issues that you believe in. Don't chase dollars. Like eventually that will come. Your first job or two might not be exactly what you want. Utilize that to build skills. And, if you kind of reach a rut, I think, going back to school, like the GSPM program, I've seen a lot of people, kind of plateau at, a program manager role, and they want to get to the next level. And I feel as though going to GSPM, getting that degree, or any of the other university, I don't want to do a shameless plug, but I will for
No, you should. It's
GSPM
okay.
since
We'll cut that. We'll cut
we're
the other
there.
unis out.
But I think that can take people to the next level. Or if that's not the right route, or finances are tough at that point in time, writing with people, reaching out and saying, "Hey, I want to do an article with you." When I first started, I did 120 articles from everything from roll call to The Hill to campaigns and elections to AAPC, presentations. I was not a known entity. I worked for a very small nonprofit and built a network by identifying win-wins. I understood the transactional nature and said, "Look, you want notoriety. Well, let's do a podcast together. We'll both share it to our networks and we'll add more people to the fold." That in a sense is a little bit transactional, but it's not for my own singular benefit. If you look for win-wins, whether it's on a legislative issue or, in the campaign world or in your career world, they're all the same. If you're working towards something that you identify as being a benefit to someone else, I think you can go a lot further.
Let's go back to the technology side because this is constantly evolving. Like next year is going to look different than this year, and this year looked definitely different than 5 years ago. What platforms do trade associations use? What platforms do campaigns use? Like we think of technology and it's kind of this amorphous, like abstract thing, but you open up your computer, what do you, besides email, what are you bringing up?
So I'm an addict for social media, LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook. I mean, that's where all of our members are still heavily Facebook. We have an older demographic in our membership, so definitely trends towards Facebook. Instagram's definitely seeing a increase there. So a lot of it is the social media side of things. Being in the tobacco industry and a highly regulated product, all of our stuff has to be organic. I cannot go on platforms and advertise. So I think it's pretty interesting because we become a lot more creative and a lot more nimble because of those limitations. So I'm spending a lot of time to do earned media. And podcast. I think that you saw it with the Trump campaign, this last election cycle, the resurgence of podcasts, and people are listening to that on the commute. So, we're looking at even things like SoundCloud and making sure that there's a lot of short form clips to long form. If you want a deep dive, you can watch this segment. If you want something short, like later today, I have a 15-minute advocacy update. Some people are doing, I know the Restaurant Association, they do like a 3-minute quick hit every week. So, creating organic content as an association and distributing it to those platforms, much like a campaign does, that seems to be the most common place where, we're spending our time.
And something lighter to get you out of here on this. Thank you for all of this. But you mentioned this is exhausting. You admit to becoming jaded a little bit. I'm sure that comes in waves as your issues come up and maybe find some obstacles to them. But how do you decompress outside of just choking down one of those Cubans you probably have in your desk? Like how do you get away?
No Cubans, Nicaragua, Dominican, and Honduras.
How
We
dare I?
only
Yep.
represent those. Let's put that clarifying point there. But no, like I'm a huge sports fan, so I go to a lot of live sporting events, UFC, F1, and hockey. I'm planning on going, hopefully, to the UFC at the White House next year. So I think that will be kind of a lot of fun. So sports and you got to love to travel too. I mean, I get to go to some interesting places and smoke cigars at some interesting places. Last few weeks I went to Normandy and on Omaha Beach having a cigar and then watching the movie, the John Wayne movie, The Longest Day, on the flight back. So those little things like that kind of keep you going. Plus, we have a really strong team. You have to build a core group. I think that as a CEO and an executive in an association, much like any other organization, the association is a reflection on not only the leader, but the people that the leader brings to the team. So, I've been fortunate to have such a great staff that they make me look good. They're coming with ideas, they're energetic about the cause. I would rather hire somebody that has a passion and an interest and a skill set. I can teach some of these basic skills, how to use technology, systems, how to communicate. I still think communication is the number one skill, but it's one that can be taught. Just having a level of enthusiasm and a little bit of a fire. You got to have that spark. Like if you look at it as a paycheck, a 9 to 5, advocacy is the wrong business. Campaigns are the wrong business for you to be in.
You can't fake passion, at least not for very long. So if you care about it, there are roles to play in here, campaign side, advocacy side, trade association side, and everything at some level will involve government. We need more people to speak the ways of not only Washington, D.C., but even more specifically of voters, members of Congress. This is what it means to get involved in getting what you want done. We all care about something. This is a route for people to take to turn those carings into something more tangible.
And it's good to see people such as yourself writing about this. I read your book on one of those flights and learned a lot about kind of where the emerging and some of the pitfalls that are going on in DC right now. And you had a lot of other great contributors to that book. And so, I think it's important for those that are listening, listen to podcasts like this that the AAPC puts on, but also look for other resources out there. I know AAPC, they put continuing learning things. Never stop learning. Just because you're not in a classroom doesn't mean you can't absorb information. And go and look for those credible sources. A lot of things are out there. GSPM's putting out articles and podcasts and things like that as well. So, I try to be as much of a sponge and soak in all that information as I can.
Amen to that. Josh, thank you for your time. AAPC, thank you for the opportunity for the conversation, and we'll kick it back.
That was Joshua Haberski and Dr. Casey Burgot with a look inside modern advocacy and how it connects with the broader political consulting ecosystem. As this conversation makes clear, campaigns and advocacy share many of the same challenges: standing out in a crowded information environment, adopting new AI technologies responsibly, and inspiring people to take meaningful action. For emerging professionals, the overlap between these fields means there are more diverse career paths than ever. Skills developed on campaigns can translate seamlessly into advocacy work, and experience in lobbying and public affairs can strengthen a consultant's strategic perspective. As the lines between these disciplines continue to blur, the future of political consulting will be shaped by professionals who understand how influence happens, not just during election cycles, but all year long. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for more conversations that explore where our industry is headed and how to grow within it.